Welcome to this evening's reading. How does this sound?
Good.
Very good. In the Gertrude Vanderbilt and Harold S. Vanderbilt Visiting Writers series, tonight it is my pleasure to introduce the poet Kate Light. It almost seems limiting to refer to Kate Light as a poet alone, since she is also a professional violinist and has played with the New York City Opera for nearly 25 years. She is a writer of song lyrics. Her song, Here Beside Me, is heard in Disney's Mulan 2. And those of us who had the privilege of hearing her with the Blair String Quartet last night know she is a maker of multimedia extravaganzas, like Einstein's Mozart, which combines her sprightly, witty commentary and verse with the music of Mozart, and Oceanophony, a remarkable exploration in words and music of the world below the waves. Truly, Kate Light wears many hats and wears them all with style. She is here tonight to read her poetry. She is the author of three highly accomplished volumes of verse, The Laws of Falling Bodies, which won the Nicholas Roerich Prize, Open Slowly, and most recently, Gravity's Dream, winner of the Donald Justice Award. Her poetry has appeared in major publications and journals throughout the country and has been favored four times by the inimitable voice of Garrison Keillor on the Writer's Almanac. Keillor also included her work in his recent anthology, Good Poems for Hard Times. Kate Light is a master of the sonnet form and frequently makes her subject the traditional theme of that form, love, romantic love, and in her case, both heartbreak and heart healing. In talking about her work with my classes, I've come to recognize that there is a notably upbeat mood that runs even through her saddest poems. It is not facile cheerfulness, but something older, more closely associated with the lyric, especially the Renaissance lyric, and the great form of the Renaissance, the sonnet. I could call it merriment, though that too may be a touch facile. I think it is gaiety, and by that I mean the gaudiness or celebration Wallace Stevens believed was essential to poetry. Many of those who have praised the poetry of Kate Light can't help but pun on her name. Those of you who own her book, Gravity's Dream. How many people here have read Gravity's Rainbow? Very good. Try, how many people have tried?
Yeah.
Well, Gravity's Dream is a better read. Those of you who own her book, Gravity's Dream, or will be purchasing it tonight after her reading, will be familiar with what Billy Collins has to say, and I quote, "It's hard to think of a poet so aptly named as Kate Light, except, of course, for Wordsworth. The step of her poems is light, and plenty of that luminous stuff is shed here." Let me add, quoting from Kate Light's Einstein's Mozart, "I, too, have a theory of light, a radical theory, that the root of all her poetry is a principle of joy." Please welcome Kate Light.
Let me know if this is...
That sounds good.
How's that? Is that good? Thank you so much, Mark. Wow. I'm inspired to feel joyous. But I'm certainly feeling joyous about being here at Vanderbilt and how welcoming everyone has been, and enjoyed the class so much today. But we'll hear from the class, I hope, more at the end. So we'll save a little time for... questions and comments, which reminds me that I left my clock over there, but so I'll refer to this 1 hour fast clock to keep an eye on things. Okay, well, what I'm going to do is zigzag a little bit between books and projects, and I'll start with something from Gravity's Dream. I'm just going to mosey over here to pick up the water, hopefully without disturbing our delicate system here. Okay. So, I'm jumping in to a somewhat challenging poem to listen to. So, bear with me. I hope it's not, you know, too challenging since you haven't heard me yet. But this poem, Crazed, the second poem in the book, is about the it's about the different positions in the family, how siblings who experience the same family life growing up yet experience it so completely differently. So maybe this will be something that some of you can relate to. And it came out of a challenge which Annie Finch, who's a really interesting, wonderful poet, sort of posed, which was that she had felt that there weren't enough poems, serious poems written in triple meters, that people sort of believed that meters that went da-da-da-da-da-da couldn't be serious. And so she was putting together an anthology of such poems. And the anthology never happened, but this poem did happen for it. So it remains, and it's called Praised. Why does she get to, one child weeps, collapses, while the mother, whose wits end in tears of her own, ricochets like a pinball to music and dance classes, teaching at three elementary schools? When do I get to, the mother, but no rules for mothers, will ask, as the hard days pass slowly, while many years seem to have furiously flown? She's up for it all, though, till sleepless she lapses. And each daughter, looking back, will be amazed, one by the short shrift of love that she feels she'd got, one by the endless capacity wasting to fight, the third stunned by a gratitude she can't express. The childhood deplored by two, the other has praised. Strange how they're made of the same fleshes, more or less, comprised of so much that each other is not, and each is convinced her perspective is right. I just detected a little change in the volume level. Did we lose our
turned off?
Seems like it. Well, I see a light. But if you can hear me fine without it,
yes,
is that?
Is it turned off?
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, it's off.
It's off.
But the little light is on. So we're getting 2 minutes of credit at the end here.
You sound fine with that.
Sounds fine. Okay.
Is that fine?
Yeah. Okay. So maybe it's just too a little distraction with you don't need. Okay. Thank you, though. Okay. Moving on. And this poem, I think, you know, sort of appropriate to this moment of travel. I had a period when I was doing, it seemed, a lot of travel, and this poem is called Packing. I don't know if there's anything more you need to know. It's kind of sonnet-like. Packing. Wait, wasn't I just unpacking? Was not this drawer, this box, this piece of luggage an open yawn just a week ago? And was that kiss goodbye? Can I be churning back to baggage that which was relaxing into residential, impinging on a ground so new? And now I'm moving everything essential, unhinging fledgling roots that grew? Leaving is everywhere, or no, is it arrival that's everywhere? Back and forth I go. Which is love and which survival? Tell me, please, so that I'll always know. Minutes ago I was stowing, storing, stacking, it seemed to be, so time does fly. And now I'm boxing, taping, packing. Here is where? Out there? In me? Oh, this will be fun. I sort of enjoy reading this poem since I'd had an experience in Japan. This is a little bit maybe off the subject, but I had an experience in Japan teaching poetry in an art university, like Pratt, and I was visiting poet professor in poetry, which they had never had before, and the English language teachers there had this idea that they would take the poems and cut out certain words, and the students would fill in the blanks and learn the meanings of the words. It was really sweet. And then discuss, you know, the poem, discuss the word and how you spell the word. And they were so cute. They were, you know, college students, you know, huddled up trying to spell font and stuff. It was just precious and wonderful. But also, one interesting thing was trying to translate words like snide, sarcasm, which, you know, are just not, I don't know, in Japanese culture, they're just not the most prevalent sort of emotional concepts. So I never quite see this poem the same ever since, but to translate sarcasm and snide. But here we go. We never fought. We never fought. We never said a nasty thing, no put down, no snide comment, no sarcasm hovering on the side. We never fought. Nothing to apologize about. You never said, shut up, I can't think, though you could have. I often said, shut up, to my thought, which was in deep worry at whether you would love me in the end, which you would not. But never fought. Only that soft comment in Europe in the car, the way you seemed to want to send me off to travel by myself. What did you say? Oh, nothing. So I forgot. I'm searching for the answer still. We never fought. We never will. Now, there's another family poem in here. This is a very short little poem. Just a fun little poem about being, I guess, seven. And this is what happened. It's called Second Poem for My Brother. My mother, in her yellow dress, itchy wool to part, asks me into a room. My father's there too. Guess what, she says. I didn't need to guess. I knew. 9 months went by, more or less, and we had you. Okay, you got it. That's good. Afterwards, you know, I always kind of want to apologize to tall people before I read this poem, because tall people can have very good posture, but anyway, here we go. Afterwards, at first I saw his shadow on every rainy day. Love, the umbrella with the question mark, I called him. Umbrella was because of the rain, and question mark was the slightly bad posture of the very tall. That was love. Umbrella with a question mark, always that. Then no umbrella, only question. Then no question, only mark. Not Mark Stern. Not Mark Norman. Okay. I realize I was reading that. Okay. Well, and yet another childhood poem. This is skipping, and I'll give you a little background on this. Because I'm from a different generation than some of you. There was a brand of tennis shoes called Red Ball Jets. I'm sure you don't know that, but there was. And what else? Do any of you remember greater than, less than? Did you do greater than, less than? A little mark, and yeah. So, you know, and the teacher said to me, you know, and this will make sense when you hear the poem, but she said, well, if the first number is bigger than the second number, then it's greater than. And if the first number is smaller than the second number, it's less than. So I took that very literally, and this is what happened. This is a poem about skipping from kindergarten to first grade in the middle of the year. Skipping. It was just a walk down the hall, the teacher, my mother, and me, skipping to another world. Books on the shelf. This is Kate. She can read, the old teacher said. New teacher, let's put her by the suggestion box, a Maxwell House tin with a hole in the lid for small hands. When you finish your work, go pick a suggestion, and she'll read it to you. Your work? Now I had a desk and red ball jets with laces tied and hung from the rung of it. I had pencils and a desk that opened from the top and gym class with children I didn't know. I was the designated reader, guardian of possibilities, tracing a turkey round my hand. What is a yes-no test? What is greater than, less than? I used my thumb and first finger to measure each number over and over. Weren't they all the same size? Yes, no. There hadn't been desks, just tables and a square, and a teacher saying, this is the letter A, while my heart sank. So I'll just take a little break from Gravity's Dream. And I'll just a very brief foray into my first book, which is almost not available anymore, but it can be found if you search a little bit, called The Laws of Falling Bodies. It's funny that my book names had these kind of, you know, inadvertent common gravity and the laws of falling bodies, and Galileo's laws. It wasn't planned that way, but as I've learned this afternoon, many things happen in your books that you don't plan. Just, oh, someone else notices them. But this poem is called Mostly, and though in the book, which my first two books have a narrative arc, if you read from the beginning to the end, which is, you know, not always the case in books of poetry, and people don't always know that either because they may just read randomly, but as this poem occurs in the book, it seems that it's a poem about letting go of a relationship. But in fact, the poem was written for a slightly different reason. Well, it is a relationship, but of a different sort. At the opera where I play, a woman, an older woman who'd been married for 50 years to someone, lost her husband, and was, of course, very sad, and she was away for a week, and then she came back, and everyone, of course, you know, meaning well, asked her how she is, and this is what she said to me, sort of. This is a sonnet, and it's called Mostly, which is also the first word. Mostly, it is the kindness I cannot bear that sets me off and sets me back. Mostly, it is the sweet wishes, the ghostly kindness lingering in the air. When I've pressed my sorrow down onto a page like a petal's pressed and have begun at last to digest reality and a bit of food, the sound of sympathy is what floods my chest and bursts me. Then, when I thought the worst was over, comes another thirst for you, sent by the sweetness guessed by kind onlookers to be what I need. When kindness kisses the wound, I bleed. And my other little just sample from this book is, you know, I haven't written very much about being a musician, just very, very little. But there was a period at the opera that, thank goodness, is over now, but that we were just losing. It was in the AIDS epidemic, and we were just losing so many people. It was just amazing. And of course, you know, when you play opera, that you're dealing with a lot of, you know, on stage, there's a lot of death and, you know, suicide and so forth. And there came a point where I just needed to make sense out of all this carnage. So I wrote this after the season. And actually, I mentioned this poem in a sideways version in class today when I was talking about, I had a poem that was written a certain way, and someone said, well, you could just repeat that line, and that might be effective. And then I realized, well, that's almost like a villanelle, so why don't I just go all the way and make it a villanelle? So it became this poem, After the Season. Do not talk to me just now. Let me be. We were up to our ears in pain and loss, and so I am reuniting all the lovers, fishing the drowned from the sea. I am removing daggers from breasts and re-zipping, making it clear who loves whom. Please go. Do not talk to me just now. Let me be. I'm redistributing flowers and potions and flutes, changing key, rewriting letters, pulling spring out of the snow. I'm reuniting all the lovers, fishing the drowned from the sea. I'm making madness sane, setting prisoners free, cooling the consumptive cheek, the fevered glow. Do not talk to me just now. Let me be. Pinkerton and Butterfly make such a happy couple. And Violetta has 5 gardens now to show. I'm reuniting all the lovers, fishing the drowned from the sea. The jester and her daughter have moved to a distant city, and Lucia colors her hair now, did you know? Come, let us sit together, let us talk, sit together, and be lovers reunited, fished like the drowned from the sea. There's some opera references in there, which some of you are catching. And so we'll just move on to Open Slowly. This is the dark book. This is with all the sort of heavier, sadder things. But and so sometimes I shy away from it a bit. But But, you know, poetry is a place to explore these things. This is not so much. This one, I don't want to frighten you that I won't get off the stage, but it's called I Never Want to Go When It's Time. I never want to go when it's time to go. I want to hang back, to read a book, or make another line rhyme. I always think that what I really need is there in the place that I am leaving, not waiting in the new place I ached to go to. I go, but with a kind of grieving, saying, why'd I ever wish to shake things up when things were really fine? To be with him, I had to yank my roots. I had to pull my bones by heartstrings, to tear my spine from land to land. Sometimes I walked a plank to reach that world and breathe and write these poems. So that was a sonnet. And this, this is a kind of almost a sonnet. Doesn't quite get there. And actually the last line is the title of a poem from my first book. So sometimes it's interesting to put these little motives, thread these little motives through your work. Let's see, does this need a little introduction? This is about, in the course of this book, the speaker's father, that's the speaker being me, I'll just say, dies. But there's a lingering illness and so forth. So this is afterwards. And it's called On. Strange that the world goes on, a stranger's screaming in the street. Strange that you who were here are gone, and we here, we weep and we sleep and we eat. I won't pass again through a door of a room on a sterilized hall. I won't climb the stairs to a third or fourth floor with your name on a plaque on the wall outside, smile and call to you, hi, it's Kate, and see you turn, which is hard. And if I'm late then, to start saying why, you're smiling at me, that's the reward for the travel and all of the work of getting there. This is a free verse poem, if I can find it. And, you know, I had a really... This is true. I it sounds sort of funny, but it was a very early poem for me, and I hadn't heard it for a long time, and it was one of the ones that Garrison Keillor read on the air, and I really felt when I heard it, I said, oh, you know, that's an interesting poem. Who wrote that? And then I realized it was mine. I mean, I really did sort of experience it that way. It didn't take me too long to figure out, but it's one of the nice things about hearing someone else read your work. It's called Unknown Neighbor. Hi, she says, leaning on the railing. What are you doing? Homework? Well, sort of, I say. I'm waiting for my friend. I'm waiting for my heart, she says. Me too, I think. My friend. Out on a long walk, I ask. Well, she says, I have a girlfriend. I've known her 50 years. Once in a while, we get together for dinner. She comes round here to Chelsea, she says. Used to be I just had arthritis and rheumatism. Now, it's a pain in the neck, I got a convulsive heart. I come from 22nd and 8th where I'm helping my brother. For me, that's a long walk. So I wait. I used to climb mountains, she says. I was young like you, she says. But I got no squawk. I've done a lot. And maybe more to do, she says. Who knows? And waving, off she goes. This is a poem that I often would read at the end of readings because it had the word conclude in the title, and so it seemed appropriate to end the reading, but this is not going to end the reading, so this will be just the, I don't know, first half, I guess, of the reading. It's called I Conclude a Sonnet Never Changed, and it's a sonnet, not surprisingly. I conclude a sonnet never changed a mind or moved a heart or opened a locked door. If such could be so readily arranged, poems could not possibly stay stocked. Pockets would be filled and pillows swarmed. Oh no, a sonnet never swung a gate, cracked a safe, or left a bomb disarmed. It never swam a moat or pried a crate, or rather whom it moved at any rate, was accidental, a side effect some poor someone tugged at when its influence, its weight, its pool of moonlight revealed a midnight shore. Yes, then, It may have changed a life or more, but not the one it was intended for. So I'm going to shift gears a bit and go to what Mark, I think, called the world under the waves. Is that what you said? I had to remember that because I may be needing a new title for this at some point. I'll have to ask him if it's okay if I use it. And this is from Oceanophony, which is similar to the piece last night some of you may have gone to or heard about, which alternates poems, a poem and music, poem and music. But this one is, sort of humorously, but also informatively about the creatures and habitats of the sea, ocean. And actually, this is the opening piece, so it's got a little, welcome thing, which is kind of part of the poem, so I'll read it. It's called Marine Snow. Marine Snow is, as the poem will tell you what it is, I guess. Because we've heard a lot about the food chain, but there's another food, alternative food source in the ocean. Marine Snow. Welcome to Oceanophony, a visit to the very deep and not so deep sea. If you swim through the blue and then go down below, you're in a continuous stream of lots of things that flow from the upper shallows to the undertow, like a breakfast that you swim in, and it's called marine snow. What is marine snow? It's a sticky mixture of nutrients falling like snow through the ocean all the time. It's interplanetary dust and cast-off shells and bits of crust, old jelly from larvations and claws of small crustaceans, leftovers of critters and diatoms and pollens, sand, spots of soot, dust mites and motes, whatever's falling through and floats, shrimpy small fry, pods and scum, wisps and wastes, bacterium, yum, wait, does that sound good to you? Well, it would if you lived down there too and all your food was tiny things that currents stirred up in the springs when all the creatures go to town with gobbling up and chowing down. It's dining not quite the way we know it, but it's mostly white and snow-like, so it has been nicknamed marine snow, the super-duper nutrient flow from the topmost surface to the way below. It's like a soup you swim in as you eat, both vegetarian and meat. Don't even need to stop and thank the copepod and nanoplankton. Just swim on and gulp a bunch. Yeah, let the snowflakes be your lunch. While a million mouths are open widening, all this food just keeps on gliding. It's dining not quite the way we know. Sum total, gummy, yummy, marine snow. Would you like one more from that? One more, okay, let's do one more. Okay, this is the puffer fish. Did I have a picture? You know what puffer fish look like. Promise me that none of you will ever hit a puffer fish with a flashlight to watch it inflate because you think that's fun. Okay. People have told me they do that, and I'm like, oh no. Don't do that because they can only inflate ever so often, and they're very vulnerable if they can't inflate when they need to and threatened. So, the puffer fish and the porcupine fish are related. These small fish are called puffers because when they are threatened, they can swallow water and puff and swell up to 3 times their size to scare off their predators. The porcupine fish has the added protection of quill-like spikes or spines that puff out when it's puffed up. When things are getting rougher for a porcupine fish or a puffer, and they think there might be trouble, they can triple on the double. Swallow water till they're bloated. If with spines they're also coated, then they're doubly protected. Because who wants to get infected or dissected or injected? And it's also unsuspected when to prickles you're subjected. It's not easy being tiny, but it helps if you are spiny and you rapidly inflate to exaggerate your weight. To puff up till they look scary makes a predator real wary. They're a very prickly parry, even if it's temporary. Porcupines have spines. Some puffers are no more than bluffers. Point of fact, they're itty-bitty till blown up. They're sitting pretty. If that fish you ate inside you grows to be so big and wide you cannot breathe, well, you are humbled. and your days are truly numbled. What to do if you're a puffer who to someone looks like supper is to turn into a huffer till you've huffed and puffed right upper. And the more spines you can flick up, well, the worse you'll be to lick up, giving fish an awful hiccup as you say, this is a stick up. Though it's all just water, really, that's upwelling in the belly, how compelling is a gesture that puts contents under pressure? When a life's at stake, you're saying, hey, it's not just games we're playing. So before I go back flattest, it's survival of the fattest. Predators who are feeling gruffish, ready to get fed and stuffish, eat some other ragamuffish. Just say nay to buffet of pufffish. Go back to the series. So I'll just, I'm going to read a few sonnets. I think that's what's next on my list, and then we can take some time for chatting, questions and stuff. This is called A Clear Conscience. The sonnets are from many years, all converged, and there's a little bit of an arc. I was able to make a little narrative arc in this part too, I think. But a clear conscience doesn't mean just cleared of guilt, but cleared of influence. To wake in a waft of light that your own consciousness has spread, when no one else's blood or brainwave has been spilt, and you're following the thread of your own craft, vibration left on the pillow when you went to bed, possessed of your own self, as it were, not forever, but for one clear day. Waking to make choices, make songs, or muse on the union that will sway you when you are ready, if you are ever ready. The question is, how many voices can you listen to, transcribe, argue with, obey? You are told you are elusive, evasive, impossible, and the arguments are so persuasive. I guess I should just check in. The volume's okay? Pretty much the room? Okay. Enough. Somehow people know, don't they, when enough is enough. But what does it mean, that amount that enough is? How is it you can count higher and higher, then suddenly there is no stuff left to count to or with? When is it you finally turn and walk and keep on walking, not looking back? For once you've gone so far, there is no back to go back to. God, I don't know. I guess I don't know even if the irreversible is. Because you never find out. That's the nature of it, the assumption. Going's the apex, the climax, the sort of redemption. When you know, our knowing for your helpless love, that you're over going over beyond what is enough. This is, I guess, an example. You know, sometimes you put a poem in your book and you're thinking, oh, should I have put this in or not? But then it turns out to be somebody's favorite, so you're glad you did. And a writer that I like and admire a lot, Elizabeth Gilbert, picked this one as her favorite, so I am very proud of that. She put it up on her refrigerator or something. So you might know her book, Eat, Pray, Love, so I feel like it's, you know, the book of people who want to read about love, so okay, here it is, Feeling for Two. Feeling for two's a woman's gift or curse. We are engineered to be that way. All the childless portion of our lives, I suppose, we rehearse that. Intuition, stick-to-itiveness, concernedness. As a child, I could not slash along the competitive lines to get what I wanted. I was too identified with those who wished for things that could be mine. The gods of greed, the creed I never deified. Well, here I am now with a few badges of waged war. Here I am getting older and less floating in possibility. And I who wave flags of more, want less of flags and more of happiness. A place in the country for quiet, for finding out what's true. A few soft shirts and lots of art and you. This is a pretty early poem called Nicknames, and this is about when you're given nicknames as a child that are intended to be funny and cute, but are actually rather painful. But there you are, vulnerable to them and stuck. And so this isn't exactly a nickname, but my mom was continually writing a book, and she still is working on this book, that went, Kate, it's just too late. So even when I was, I don't know, 3 or something, it was already too late. But she meant well. And someone I know named Bruce, his father called him Useless Bruce. Nice. So this is called Nicknames or Undoing the Snaps for Bruce, whose father called him Useless Bruce. I am not late, Kate, and you are useful, Bruce, and we are undoing the snaps. A truce with jokes that heard too young, went in too deep, and slept beside us when we'd sleep. Now we can thank ourselves for real, for food that we can live on, yikes, and make ourselves over out of. A new skin, they say, occurs every 2 weeks, and every 6 months, a new liver. It has been 3 months now that you have been my lover. Freshly skinned and half a liver later, love, I wait for you under organic sheets of paper and beneath polluted skies, saying, oh, sigh on the dotted lines, my eyes. Okay, I'm almost done here. A couple more. When I was writing Oceanophony, I had a little trouble getting started, and I was reading a lot about fish, a lot. And going to aquariums and watching videos and watching the Discovery Channel. Anyway, so the fish images started to come out in regular poems, but I still hadn't written the Oceanophony poems. And here's one of those poems. It's called The Idea is the Fleeting Ghostly Fish. And I think because you've heard Maureen Snow, you'll recognize some things. The idea is the fleeting ghostly fish that's lit up in the world of fathoms deep, announcing its arrival with a swish that makes the waters murmur in their sleep. There always blooms that steady stream of snow like plankton fallout in the sea of brain, from which you snitch a thought, not yes, not no, but something from the world's incessant rain. The ghostly fish that's lit up from within and bright enough to catch your eye that sweeps the depths or reaches or the narrow place. Its luminescence gets beneath your skin and cheers you when it finds your tear-stained face. And if you mimic it or rise to match its pace, then you become the company it keeps. Okay, so 2 more. And these are the very, very end of the book. This is perhaps the closest, you know, kind of classical sonnet that I've written. It's called 35, and it takes as a line from Shakespeare's sonnet 40, which says, take all my loves, my love, yea, take them all. Take them all, my love, all loves that passed like bloodstreams through me so and made me weep. Still, weeping shows it had its worth at last. It drew the furrows and the runnels deep through which love frowns and flows. And now those peaks and cracks, those vales and heights have forged a way for yours. How great is love that great ease seeks? The gasps and gaps in what one tries to say, the stoppages, the conduits that tore and healed, the cells that still await repair, the echoes in the walls as we explore these selves that are somewhat the worse for wear. Although I wish, my love, that I were free, I'm not. You take them all in taking me. And last, to you. I'm writing to you now. There was no you, except a kind of guess that maybe someone here or there would catch a drift of wit or recognition or, forgive my unworthiness, inspiration. Taken for stiff by some, undisciplined by others, all true, all true. I bow my head before these judgment gods, and if now some small following lifts that head back up, as I've said, by the tip of the chin, looks into the eyes, looks in, says, I accept these things as gifts, then, okay, you're who I'm writing for, far off or near, who I'm here biting my lip to be clear to. Yes, you. Yes, you. Thanks. So we can have some discussion, or if there are any requests, we could probably accommodate that too. Any questions?
I've never asked anybody, but could you read "I Never Want to Go When It's Time Again"?
Again? Okay.
Do you mind?
I don't mind if you don't mind.
Thanks.
they're short. But where is it? It's in the table of contents.
Okay. But if that messes up your rhythm, I don't want to.
It's okay with me. It's a sonnet. I never want to go when it's time. I never want to go when it's time to go. I want to hang back to read a book or make another line rhyme. I always think that what I really need is there in the place that I am leaving, not waiting in the new place I ached to go to. I go, but with a kind of grieving, saying, why'd I ever wish to shake things up when things were really fine? To be with him, I had to yank my roots. I had to pull my bones by heartstrings, to tear my spine from land to land. Sometimes I walked a plank to reach that world and breathe and write these poems.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
The two oceanographic poems you read, are those like something, you said that they were new, like you're making a new collection with those, or what were they from?
They're from a performance piece, a 45-minute long alternating music and poetry music by Bruce Adolph that was premiered in it was commissioned by the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, and the Chamber Music Festival out there, Summerfest La Jolla, and premiered in 2003, summer of 2003, and then came out in CD in 2004, and we've performed it. We or others have performed it about 51 times around the country, but it's in limbo now. It's in a limbo, which is a complicated story. But you can get that CD online. If that's interesting to you.
Since you are a person whose art kind of exists in two mediums, and you've done pieces, as you just discussed, where you've paired poems with musical pieces, do you find that musical pieces evoke certain poems for you, or vice versa? Not necessarily like your own music, your own poetry, but do you find the two connecting in your mind?
That's a similar question to what I had earlier. It's a great question, and I had a little trouble answering it. Because I guess when I hear the question, I'm thinking that you're asking about, you know, very specific, you know, music creating a very specific response, poetic response, and I'm not sure if I understand the question, if I misunderstand the question, or if I can interpret it in some other way. But I mean, music does, I think, get people's thoughts flowing, so that, you know, that happens. I went through a period where I was trying to write, you know, some. I played a lot of Bach, solo Bach, and I was trying to write poems that were in my mind to that music, but no one would necessarily know that but me, and it didn't really work. I was going to write a suite of poems that didn't work, but it was kind of an interesting theoretical idea. But definitely, you know, there's a kind of music that, you know, there's something that's going on that's... Do you want to... I don't know.
You answered it exactly.
Did you have any, interesting things that you discovered about form yourselves as you were exploring form, or that certain kinds of form, you know, were conducive to certain kinds of emotions or anything? Because I mean, personally, I think the villanelle is an interesting form because it, because the lines come back and come back, and so, you have this challenge of, you know, how does that operate for you? And I was told early on that you can't, you know, it's not a good form for narrative because you can't sort of move forward. So I was like, got to try that, and you know, was able to use it to work for narrative. But it's great for any kind of obsession or, you know, returning thoughts.
Have you written a Sestina?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, it's in the first book. It's about Tchaikovsky. Yeah, I was reading Tchaikovsky's diaries, and he was obsessed, clearly obsessed with certain things, and there were 6 of them, and so I thought, oh, I was like, okay. And actually, I tell people that it's the poem I worked the hardest on, and yet I feel I didn't really write a word of it because it was all taken from his diary, but. But, you know, just organizing that material and trying to, of course, it's a translation, but, you know, trying to get blocks of text that, you know, could, that either really did occur consecutively or that could have occurred consecutively and maintaining the form. He was obsessed.
Can you tell us a little bit about a few of the things that he was obsessed with?
Yeah, he was
obsessed. A few of the 6 things.
Yeah, he was obsessed with... his nephew Bob, with whom he was in love, his 16-year-old nephew. He was obsessed with whist, a gambling card game, and with his own state of health, thinking that he was ill, and with walking, going for walks. Let's see, what were the other things?
So was it Bob or nephew then?
Bob. I mean, you know, it doesn't sound like a Russian name, does it? But so it was in the diary. And that, you know, what I was trying to do was, do you want to hear it? It's okay. Because by the time I explain it, it's almost, it's a little bit longer than some of my poems, obviously. It's longer than a sonnet. 39 lines. Okay, so diary 3. And so you need to know that, what do you need to know? That Sasha was his sister, and you know already about Bob, and you know what whist is, so I guess that's it. Yes. Oh, so because it's a diary, and you know how people are, they have different moods on different days, what I did, I used italics, so I'm an italics person, to alternate. One day would be in straight type, and then the next would be in italics, so you would know it was a different day. So that you won't see that, so I try to indicate it with my voice. Diary 3. Last night after supper with D and B, a real game of whist. But I am ill and do not see the end of my sickness. Awoke today with a pain in my throat and nausea, even so I worked. Sasha, Nata, cousin, picked lilies of the valley with Bob. Had a pain in my heart which frightened me. Nonetheless, a morning walk. Very dissatisfied with the ideas that come to me. Angry because of bad luck. Am I played out? Wrote to N, was angry on returning home because lunch was not ready. Whist, foursome after supper. A miracle, I won. Magnificent day. Walked all morning in the Trotsianka forest. Walked long and didn't feel sick. Took part in the Pas de Guillon after tea with G, B, and Bob. How hard it has become for me to work. I strained myself too much in my work. Was again furious, malicious, and angry. Did not mention tonight's strange dreams, rambling with Bob, Tarnowski governess, etc., English language, whist, after supper. Played the piano long, returned home half sick, looked at a wonderful sunset, drank tea, walked in the garden. The day was so-so. In the morning, took a short walk on the road to the railroad station, worked. This whist threesome irritates me so that I make myself sick. Nothing results except for being upset and angered. Then to what purposes do I play whist? Whist with E. Duets with my darling, the incomparable, ideal Bob. Ah, oh, how perfect is Bob. How fascinating is Bob. How perfectly charming he is in his white suit. Walked to the railroad station. Flagon is ill, so played whist with Lev, very dull. And for long, as I am ahead in my work. Because Sasha set me 2 tricks in hearts, I got angry as a madman. Oh, Peter Ilyich, shame, Holy Father. I've been sick since morning, so exasperated, I imagined I would do harm, sick at the thought of going away. I think it's on account of Bob. Finished the Andante, which, with which I'm very satisfied. less angry than usual, played some of my songs for Bob before dinner, walked to the forest and back. God, how I love him. Managed to work just a little. There was no whist at all. I confess, whist is almost a necessity for me. Walked all morning, sick all day, though I worked well. Nata, cousin, Bob on horseback. Then whist and endless anger. He did. He wrote this. He would write, you know, one sentence, you know, very, you know, he just fought, you know, anger. Whist, Bob.
What was Bob's last name?
I don't know. Tchaikovsky, no. This is his nephew. I don't know.
Well, let's go outside. There's a reception and food for sale outside.
Thank you so much.